Turning now to the question of the accents in ancient Greek, we may observe that most modern languages, including English and modern Greek, have stress accents. That is, in the pronunciation of a word, the accented syllable is given more stress or intensity than the other syllables. In the English words comfort and reason, we clearly hear that the accent is on the first syllable, while in the words defend and restore, we hear the accent on the last syllable. In all four words, the accented syllable is given more stress than the unaccented syllable. In certain cases, such as the English word spelled P-R-O-G-R-E-S-S, it is mainly by the stress accent that we can tell whether the word is the noun, progress, or the verb, progress. Other modern languages, such as Norwegian and Chinese, instead of stress accents, have musical pitch or tone accents. This is also true of ancient Greek. In the pronunciation of words in ancient Greek, the accented syllable is given not necessarily more stress than the other syllables, but a higher musical pitch or tone than the other syllables. Although stress might occur on an accented syllable to express some personal emphasis, it might equally occur on an unaccented syllable. In other words, there is no necessary relationship between stress and the pitch accent in ancient Greek. In our goal of learning to pronounce ancient Greek correctly, we must include the sounding of the musical pitch accent. For just as in English, the Greek accent is an integral phonemic part of the word, and in some cases the accent is a decisive factor in distinguishing the meaning between two otherwise identical words. For example, the Greek word alla, accented on the first syllable, means other things, while the word alla, accented on the second syllable, means but. Now, it might seem at first that to learn a system of musical pitch accents would be very difficult for native speakers of a language which has only stress accents. It is, in fact, this apprehension which has in the past discouraged many students and teachers of ancient Greek from attempting to learn and to apply the pitch accents. Yet if we listen attentively to everyday spoken English, we will hear many different musical pitches, all employed to convey a variety of personal expressions and feelings. It would sound very strange and ultimately very boring if I or anyone else were to speak steadily without pitch variation. We'd all end up asleep. Spoken English does then have extensive pitch variations, although these variations are usually part of phrase or sentence intonation rather than being an integral part of individual words. In our study of the Greek pitch accents, we shall make use of the more familiar pitch variations in spoken English. The written accent marks which we use today for ancient Greek were introduced in the Alexandrian period around 200 BC, an invention attributed to the scholar Aristophanes of Byzantium. These accent marks were apparently intended for foreigners, such as ourselves, who were learning Greek. They served as a visual guide for the proper musical movement of the voice. There are three accent marks. These represent the acute accent, the circumflex accent, and the grave accent. There are specific rules for the placement of these three accents, that is, for which accent goes on which syllable. These rules are relatively simple and can be learned from a Greek grammar or from most elementary Greek textbooks. They are, however, beyond the immediate scope of this recording, which is concerned with the pronunciation of the accents. Let's first consider the pronunciation of the acute accent over a short vowel. An example of this is found in the Greek word for reason or word, which has an acute accent on the first syllable. Logos, logos. If you listen carefully, I believe you heard no greater stress or loudness on the first syllable than on the second, but you heard that the musical pitch of the first syllable is higher than the pitch of the second syllable. I'll repeat the word twice, leaving a pause after each repetition for you to practice this sound of the acute accent. Logos, logos. The next example of the acute accent over a short vowel is the Greek word for street, which has an acute accent on the last syllable. Hodos. Hodos. Again, if you listen carefully to the two syllables, you heard not a difference in stress, but that the musical pitch of the second syllable is higher than that of the first syllable. I'll repeat this word twice with similar pauses. Hodos. Hodos. What interval in pitch should there be between the unaccented syllable and the syllable with the acute accent? Our evidence from ancient sources is not absolutely clear on this point. Presumably, the interval was usually not larger than a musical fifth. La, la. But the interval may often have been less than a fifth, perhaps a musical fourth. La, la. Or a musical third. La, la. In any case, I strongly believe that there was no one absolute interval, but that the interval could vary with the speaker and with the occasion or circumstances. What was important was that the listener could at all times clearly hear that the accented syllable had a higher pitch than the other syllables. This is our fundamental principle of discernible distinctions in sound, of which I spoke previously. In the pronunciation of an acute accent over a long vowel or over a diphthong, we again hear that the accented syllable has a higher pitch than the unaccented syllable. However, there is in this case a more gradual rise in pitch from the beginning of the accented syllable to its culminating point at the end of the syllable, followed by a descent in pitch to the following syllable. Both the rise and descent in pitch is in the form of a glide from one pitch to the other. An example of this can be heard in the Greek word for mother, which has an acute accent on the first syllable. Mater. Mater. Notice how the voice glides upward in the first syllable and downward in the second syllable. I'll repeat this word twice with pauses for you to practice the acute accent over a long vowel. Mater. Mater. The next example of the acute accent over a long vowel is the Greek word for Anna, which has an acute accent on the last syllable. Dima. Dima. Again, I'm sure you heard the gradual glide upward in the last syllable. I'll repeat this word twice with pauses. Dima. Dima. The sign for the acute accent, then, is essentially a visual representation of the vocal movement. It starts low and points upward toward the end of the syllable. This is apparently what the voice is supposed to do. The sign for the circumflex accent is similarly a visual indication of the vocal pattern. It curves upward and then downward, but in the same syllable. An example of this may be heard in the Greek word for slave, which has a circumflex accent over the first syllable. Doulos. Doulos. Notice here how the voice glides upward and downward in the first syllable. I'll repeat this word twice with pauses for practice. Doulos. Doulos. Next, we have an example in the Greek word meaning I win of a circumflex accent over the last syllable. Niko. Niko. Again, notice the upward and downward glide in the last syllable. I'll repeat this word twice with pauses. Niko. Niko. As you may have observed, The vocal pattern of upward and then downward glide is applicable to both the acute accent and the circumflex accent. The difference between the two lies in where the downward glide occurs. In the case of the acute accent, the downward glide occurs in the syllable following the accent. In the case of the circumflex accent, the downward glide occurs in the same syllable as the upward glide. Since a circumflex accent can occur only over a long vowel or a diphthong, there was presumably sufficient time to execute the upward and downward glide within the same syllable without difficulty. One way of clarifying the vocal distinction between the acute accent and the circumflex accent is to compare them to two common usages of the English word yes. If you enter a department store in which a sales lady is not too busy chattering with her colleagues to notice you, she might turn to you and say, "Yes," in the sense of, "Can I help you?" Yes. The upward glide in the word yes is what we aim for in the acute accent, particularly over a long vowel, as in dima, yes. Over a short vowel, the glide will be much more rapid. If, however, you enter the same department store and ask the sales lady a strange question such as, "Is this store closed at 3 o'clock in the morning?" you might receive an emphatic and somewhat indignant answer sounding like, "Yes, yes." Notice here the upward and downward glide within the same syllable, corresponding to the circumflex accent, as in Niko, yes. Perhaps another fantasy episode will further aid in hearing and reproducing the difference between the acute and circumflex accents. Just imagine a college freshman, Jeannie, running breathlessly into the room of her friend Sophie and blurting out, "Gee, I just saw Dean Milktoast kissing his secretary." Sophie, in amazement, says, "What, him?" To which Jeannie replies, "Yes, him." If we can manage to detach our thoughts from the dramatic excitement of this episode and concentrate on the sound of the word him, the first time the word has an upward glide, "What, him?" corresponding to the acute accent, "Dima, him?" The second time the word has an upward and downward glide, "Yes, him," corresponding to the circumflex accent, "Niko, him." I'm sure that these unforgettable examples from English or others that you yourself can think of, equally unforgettable, can be of help in distinguishing the acute accent from the circumflex accent. In any case, the difference in sound between the acute and circumflex accents was clear and discernible to the ancient Greeks. A confusion between the two could lead to dire consequences. In a performance in 408 BC of Euripides' tragedy, Orestes, the actor Hegelicus was reciting the line which was supposed to mean, "After the tempest I behold once more the calm." The word for calm in Greek is galan, with the upward glide of the acute accent on the last syllable. However, instead of saying galan, he said galan, with the upward and downward glide of the circumflex accent. This change of accent changed the meaning of the line into, "After the tempest I behold once more a weasel." For this slip of the tongue, poor Hegelicus was apparently hissed and hooted from the theater, perhaps never daring to return. The pronunciation of the grave accent is one of the few aspects of the pronunciation of ancient Greek on which scholars are not in complete agreement. Some scholars believe that a syllable with a grave accent was pronounced with a pitch which was intermediary between the low pitch of a normal unaccented syllable and the high pitch of a syllable with an acute accent. In other words, a middle tone. Others have held that the grave accent was pronounced in exactly the same way as the acute accent, a view which seems to me most improbable. A third view, and one which I personally share, but which limitations of time do not allow me to discuss, is that the grave accent is a visual indication that the voice, instead of rising to a higher pitch, remains on the basic low pitch of the unaccented syllables. This is the interpretation of the grave accent which I apply in my own reading of Greek. I think it would be helpful at this point to provide some additional practice in the pronunciation of the pitch accents. This can serve at the same time as a further review of the pronunciation of the vowels and consonants. I'll read 20 individual words in Greek, pronouncing each word twice, with pauses for practice. After that, I'll read one complete Greek sentence in prose so that you can hear the sound of a natural sequence of words with their different vowels, consonants, and accents. Both the individual words and the complete sentence are printed in the accompanying booklet. First, the 20 words. The English meaning is given before the Greek word. 1. Messenger. Angelos. Angelos. 2. Brother. Adelphos. Adelphos. 3. Man. Anthropos. Anthropos. 4. Clear. Dalos. Dalos. 5. Gift. Dorun. Dorun. 6. Collect. Atroisdo. Atroisdo. 7. Foreigner. Barbarus. Barbarus. 8. From there. Inteutin. Inteutin. 9. Strong. Iskyros. Iskyros. 10. Village. Goma. Goma. 11. Silence. Siga. Siga. 12. Protect. Pilato. Pilato. 13. Athenian. Athenaios. Athenaios. 14. Conspire. Epibuleo. Epibuleo. 15. Soldier. Stratiotas. Stratiotas. 16. Grieve. Actomai. Actomai. 17. Prevent. Goluo. Goluo. 18. I agree. Homologo. Homologo. 19. Die. Apotheneisko. Apotheneisko. 20. Song. Oida. Oida. Here now is a complete sentence. It is the opening sentence of Plato's Apology of Socrates. I'll read this sentence twice. The first time, slowly, with an emphasis on clarity of pronunciation. The second time, in what I imagine is a more natural manner of delivery. Here is the first reading. Potimen hyme so andri satanaioi pipuntate hypoton imon kategoron uk oida. Igo dun kai autos hypauton oligu emautu epilatoman. Uto pitanos iligun. Kai toi alatis gossiposipin uden irakasin. Here now is the second reading.
Hotimen hyme so andri saten ajoi pipuntate hypotonimon kategoron uk oida. Igo dun kai autos hypauton oligu emautu epilatuman. Uto pitanos siligun. Kai toi alatis gossiposipin uden irakasin.
We come now to the sound of rhythm in ancient Greek poetry. The rhythm of much modern poetry, including English and modern Greek poetry, is based upon patterns of stressed and unstressed syllables. In most cases, the stressed syllables match the normal word accents, which in these languages is based upon stress. In English, stress is generally accompanied by a rise in pitch and a lengthening of the stressed syllable. Rhythm based upon stress can be clearly heard in these lines from Marlowe's Faustus. Was this the face that launched 1,000 ships and burnt the topless towers of Ilium? In our previous discussion of accents, we saw that the pitch accents of ancient Greek have no regular or necessary relationship with stress. We can now make the additional observation that the pitch accents have no regular or necessary relationship with poetic rhythm. In ancient Greek, the rhythm of the poetry is based upon syllabic quantity or duration, that is, upon patterns of long and short syllables. But, and I repeat for emphasis, the rhythmic patterns of long and short syllables have no necessary relationship with the patterns of accented and unaccented syllables. These two aspects of the sound of ancient Greek poetry, word accents and syllabic quantity, are independent and distinct phenomena. This distinction must be borne in mind and then applied to the correct reading of ancient Greek poetry. Since all ancient Greek poetry was based upon rhythmic patterns of long and short syllables, it is obviously necessary for the reader to determine which syllables are long and which are short. There are four general rules to determine syllabic quantity. 1. A syllable may be classified long either by nature or by position. 2. A syllable is classified long by nature if it contains a long vowel, such as eta, omega, long alpha, long iota, long upsilon, or any diphthong. This syllable is said to be long by the nature of its vowel or diphthong. 3. A syllable is classified long by position if it contains a short vowel, such as epsilon, omicron, short alpha, short iota, short upsilon, that is then followed by at least two successive consonants, which may include the double consonants zdeta, xi, and psi. This syllable is said to be long by the position of its vowel in front of two or more consonants. Apparently, the combination of a short vowel plus two consonants was presumed to have approximately the same time duration as a long vowel or a diphthong. 4. If a syllable does not qualify as long, either by nature or by position, it is classified short. There are some exceptions to these general rules that time prevents us from discussing here. These exceptions are summarized in the accompanying booklet. Once we can determine whether a syllable is long or short, we are in a position to scan or to give the scansion of a line of poetry. Scanning or scansion is the process of identifying the quantity or length of each successive syllable of a line of poetry. If you are learning the procedure for the first time, it is simplest to write out the scansion above or below the line of poetry, copied onto a sheet of paper, using the traditional symbols for long and short syllables. After you are proficient at the written scansion, the process should be continued orally, by taking a line of poetry and identifying aloud the quantity of each successive syllable. At first, the oral scansion will be slow and hesitant. This is only natural, for we are, in a sense, learning how to walk. The aim at this stage should not be speed or acceleration. We should aim at achieving a steady flow of patterned long and short syllables so that a sense of the rhythm of the verse can be developed. This feel for the rhythm can be acquired even if the oral scansion is done at a slow tempo. Naturally, once proficiency and confidence have increased through practice, the tempo can also be gradually increased. As I said previously, there is no absolute time duration for either the long or the short syllable. The time duration of these syllables, and therefore the tempo, will vary with the speaker, with the mood, and with the occasion. All that counts is that the listener be able to hear a clear distinction in quantity between the long and the short syllables. Let us now examine in detail the scansion and reading of the dactylic hexameter, one of the most important and yet structurally the simplest of the rhythms in ancient Greek poetry. The principles and procedures of scansion and reading that we learn from the dactylic hexameter can later be applied to other, more complex rhythms. A hexameter is a verse of 6 equal measures or parts. A dactyl is a succession of 1 long syllable followed by 2 short syllables. The pattern sounds like la la la. A pure dactylic hexameter, then, is composed theoretically of 6 measures of dactyls. In practice, however, the last measure of the dactylic hexameter is always a measure of 2 syllables, either long, long, la, la, a sequence known as a spondi, or long, short, la, la, a sequence known as a trochee. A dactylic hexameter with 5 dactyls followed by a final spondi would have a rhythmic pattern which sounds like la 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 la. However, in addition to there frequently being a spondi in the last measure of the verse, a spondi can also be substituted for a dactyl in any of the other measures of the hexameter. This possibility of substitution of spondees for dactyls allows for greater flexibility of composition for the poet and for greater variety of rhythmic effects for the listener. In the 3rd or 4th measure of the dactylic hexameter, there usually occurs a separation or a break between words. This break is known by the Latin expression caesura, spelled C-A-E-S-U-R-A, which means literally a cutting. The nature and the effect of the caesura is too complex and debated a subject to discuss here. However, insofar as the oral rendition of the hexameter is concerned, I'll simply state that I do not believe that there is an automatic pause at the point of caesura.